You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. There's growing fallout from last week's controversy over a fraternity at the University of Oklahoma. A video was leaked showing fraternity members doing a racist chant referencing lynching and in derogatory language stating that the fraternity would never include African Americans.
The university has since banned that fraternity chapter and expelled two students involved. Today, the national fraternity organization, Sigma Alpha Epsilon, apologized, announced a nationwide review of its chapters, along with a new diversity initiative.
Our next guest says this isn't just a story about one fraternity chapter or even about fraternities in general. In his research, he spent a lot of time talking to young white men in higher education, and he says invisible racism is common on our nation's campuses.
Nolan Cabrera joins us now. He's an assistant professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona. Nolan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm going to start with the offending language in this video that got the fraternity chapter of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE, closed. I'm going to say N-word over the original language. There will never be an N-word
that.
SAE. You can hang them from a tree, but they'll never sign with me. There will never be an N-word SAE. So, Nolan, based on your research, are you surprised to hear this from a group of white college students?
Not at all. It's actually more common than not in the white men who I interview to have them either hear or even say the N-word on a very regular basis. And I think what's most troubling for me is that they don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's almost a word that they use for shock value, something to play with, kind of the way that kindergartners are obsessed with fecal matter. It's sort of that this is the next generation of that. And unfortunately, what they completely disregard in that process is that this word is specifically meant to demean, dehumanize, and they have no sense of the social context or the power of the term, so they just play around with it, and it's very, very common around college campuses.
Now, there have been other fraternity scandals in the news lately, a new one in Pennsylvania over a gender issue there, a fraternity banned here in Wisconsin over hazing. So this story has been viewed a lot through the lens of fraternities gone wrong. But is this something wider than just a fraternity story, Nolan?
There's two different things. On the one hand, no, this isn't fraternities gone wrong. This is fraternities getting caught. This is a predictable outcome of the fraternity structure, where there's minimal accountability, minimal method diversity, and in many respects, these are only the ones that are floating to the surface. On the other hand, you are correct that this isn't just a fraternity issue in the sense that, only maybe about 10 to 12% of the students I interview actually has some sort of fraternity affiliation. And in many respects, the colloquial use of the N-word and just playing with it in what I view are completely inappropriate ways is rampant. It's not just a fraternity issue. But what it is it's an issue that exists when white people in general, and white men in particular, have the ability to exist in environments where they don't have people of color around them, when they don't have black people around them. And really, that's sort of the biggest issue, that in many respects, students of color are blamed for campus self-segregation, and in many respects, it's actually white people who are doing the greatest segregating.
Now, in your research, you've mentioned you talk to young white men, in particular on campuses. How do you get them to frankly express their views on race?
They don't have to. When they're talking to me, and as my department head says, I am obviously a person of color, and I even identify myself as such at the beginning of the interviews. But these are interviews where I'm reaching out to them and saying, you can express your views confidentially. You can talk to me, and whatever you say, that's as long as it's representative of your views, that's okay. Not okay in a moral sense, but that's what the interview should be able to do, and they take that as license to just say whatever on their mind. There's no accountability in my interviews because I have no power over them. And also what I've been finding is that a lot of these young men, they feel very censored regarding issues of race. Now, there's nothing they can specifically point to. It's not like someone called them out in a class. They just feel like their views aren't valued. So they have these really strong views of race and racism, but they just never say them. So it almost becomes sort of a type of racial therapy. They just want to cathartically get it out of their system.
Now, you've talked about it, and I think your dissertation was titled Invisible Racism. This kind of racism, and this is a tough judgment maybe, but is this conscious, intentional bias against people of a different race, or is this a matter of unquestioned assumptions that everybody else is doing, so people just kind of do it without thinking about it?
That distinction for me is actually completely irrelevant in the respect that if somebody comes up to a black kid and uses the N-word, or uses the N-word and it gets caught the way that it did in SAE, the effect on the kid is still the same. The effect on the student is still the same, whether you intended to or not. And I think we actually unintentionally derail the really important racial conversations that we need to have because we're constantly looking for intentionality. And in many respects, it allows people to say racist things and do racist actions and then say, but it really wasn't racist because I didn't intend to offend. And my point is that I'm not concerned with what you intended to do. It's what you did do that's the most important part.
So apart from what we've heard in this Oklahoma story, what kind of things have you heard from these young, white, mostly male students? What are their views on race? What kind of attitudes and behaviors that do they tell you about?
My goodness, that's an extremely in-depth conversation, so I'll try to give you the Reader's Digest version. in many respects, they tend to exist in very racially homogenous environments. And coming to college, despite the diversity of a lot of the campuses that they attend, they don't necessarily interact across race except for very superficial ways. And then when issues of race do come up, it tends to very much be about how they perceive themselves to be victimized. They see themselves, in particular the combination of being white and male, as excluding them from participation in for being competitive for scholarships. I almost didn't get into this school because of affirmative action, because less qualified white women and minorities got in ahead of me. And there's this very, very pertinent discourse of reverse racism, which lacks any empirical foundation, but they really honestly do feel that way. And that's in addition to some just very overtly racist things that they do and say in their daily lives, racial joking, using the N-word. But again, they do it behind closed doors because they come from a general ideological orientation that, well, minorities are overly sensitive on issues of race, so I don't want it to be misconstrued. They don't think that they're doing anything wrong, and actually kind of challenge that notion. I think they really deep down do know they're doing something wrong, which is because if they didn't, they would do it out in public. But they don't. They do it behind closed doors, or what Peek and Fagan refer to as backstage racism.
So I'll ask you another huge, complicated question. How do we start changing that conversation? How do we get the people we're talking about to talk openly and maybe explore these attitudes a little more deeply?
Well, the big thing that we need to understand is that diversity initiatives in higher education cannot be piecemeal. All too often, a campus or university will increase the proportions of students of color on campus and say, okay, cool, we've done our diversity work. When in fact, it's multifaceted, it's multi-pronged, and most importantly, they need to be engaged as a concerted effort. So, you need increasing the proportion of students of color on campus is important, but then you need to foster areas like intergroup dialogues where people can have meaningful cross-racial interactions and have these deeper discussions across race. You need to embed it into diversity into the overall structure of the institution. Is it part of the accountability structure for administrators? Is it part of the assessment of the efficacy of the overall institution? Or is it going to be the way we usually talk about diversity as kind of a convenient little add-on if we think about it, or if we actually want to do something about it? It would be cute if we could engage diversity. Or do we consider diversity to be sort of at the core, at the crux of the education that we're doing?
Now, in this particular instance in Oklahoma, the university's response, banning this fraternity, the national fraternity's response to close down this chapter, a couple of students expelled by the university. What do you make of the particular response in this instance?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of different issues going on. One, the open condemnation of the fraternity in many respects is sort of a way of trying to make it seem like it's an isolated incident, or that it doesn't have larger ramifications. Like the, I believe the terminology the University of Oklahoma president used was that we have a zero tolerance policy for racism in Oklahoma, which is, if you took that out to its logical extension, it holds no weight. It's no, that you have a zero tolerance policy for overt instances of racism that got caught on tape, put on YouTube, and then embarrassed the institution on the national media. Having said that, in student affairs work around colleges and universities, there's constantly this mantra that, we need to make these into teachable moments. Teachable moments are important for the moral and individual development of students on campus. But my problem with that, and specifically in instances that are so egregious as this one, is that the students knew what they were doing was wrong. It would be really hard to find people who don't necessarily think that what they did was wrong. And they did it anyway. And for me, that sort of moves the discussion beyond a teachable moment. It's an instance where, what are you going to teach them? In this, and so in some respects, it becomes more of a teachable moment for the institution as a whole. That is, that don't do this as a teachable moment to the other fraternities and sororities and even just the general campus community.
We're talking to Nolan Cabrera from the University of Arizona about what he calls invisible racism in higher education, racism that plays out behind the scenes, behind closed doors when no one's watching or when no one's thought to be watching, with last week's fraternity scandal in Oklahoma as a recent example.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in your life, in higher education or elsewhere? Do people, do you think, feel comfortable using racially charged language when they're not in the public eye? And how do you react to that if you're present? What do you think about it? What do you think is the appropriate response to this incident in Oklahoma? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation about invisible racism, racially charged language behind the scenes when people are out of the public eye. And this follows last week's leak of a video showing members of an Oklahoma fraternity performing a chant talking about keeping African Americans out of their organization.
Nolan Cabrera from the University of Arizona stays with us. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this story from Oklahoma? What was your reaction? What do you think the response should be? And do you think there's a lot of behind-closed-doors expression of racially charged attitudes, language, behavior? Have you encountered it yourself? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Donna on the line in Burlington. Donna, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to say I have been following the story somewhat, and I wasn't surprised. But I added my name to the Facebook page of the president of the university who had decided to disband the fraternity. I was very happy to hear that. I was also very happy to hear that I finally have a name, Invisible Racism, because when all the stuff came out about Ferguson and New York, there would be a lot of people making comments on threads. And a lot of the white people I saw made claims that racism doesn't exist. Most of these people were people who came from white communities. As a white person, though, I said, when I get behind closed doors, I live in an all-white community or almost all-white, and I said, when people think no one else is around except for white people that they know, they feel it's okay to express themselves. And I said, I know that racism is alive and well because I hear it behind closed doors when nobody thinks it matters.
Donna, thank you so much for that call. Nolan Cabrera, do you think that Donna's story is common around the country?
It's absolutely common throughout the country. That a big problem why these racial issues continue to persist is that we're not able to have a meaningful conversation about it because there's such a persistent denial that racism is at all an issue. And so instead of actually saying, let's figure out strategies to meaningfully engage it, we instead are even debating, which is, in my opinion, an asinine debate as to whether or not racism still exists. And it's something that people are continually, let's try to move beyond it. Let's try to move beyond it. And the more that we try to move beyond it instead of meaningfully engage it, the worse these problems get in the process. And, Donna's comment about, being a white person and speaking out on these issues is actually critically important, because she has access to these areas where a lot of people of color don't. And so in many respects, it becomes even of greater importance for people like her to engage these issues, to speak out on these issues, and to disrupt these behind-closed-door racism that occurs on a very regular basis.
Donna, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Berhat in Milwaukee. Berhat, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I was listening to the show, and I remember even when I first heard that this tape, it's not very surprising. If you ever go online, especially if you play online video games, it's like prevalent for white males to either just directly say blatantly racist things, or they'll have a character who has a darker complexion and they'll name her like Kanisha or something, and then say that, you know, she's a hood chick or she's a welfare queen. It's so prevalent, like online in different games, on Xbox Live. It's surprising that, you know, people even find it surprising.
Berhat, thanks for the call. Nolan, your thoughts?
There were two really important issues that Berhat just brought up. One is that on the online community, it becomes a really important way for this racism to manifest, because even though you have a virtual contact with somebody, you don't actually have a contact with a person. And so in many respects, it's those instances where our worst selves come out, our deepest, darkest selves come out. And it's so... It's so prevalent, and we don't even consider that, because so much of it we talk about is interpersonal. But in many respects, those are the areas where it manifests so dramatically. And I really, the second part is just that, yeah, it's most surprising that it is surprising, I guess, is sort of the best way that I can talk about it. That I'm most surprised by how surprised people were that these issues came up, and it actually speaks to how we haven't engaged race and how we're not continuing to engage it in a meaningful way moving ahead.
Berhat, thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go next to Margaret with us in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say I think that was deplorable what those students were doing, and the fashion that they were doing it was very disrespectful. But yet what concerns me is the fact that when it's a white person using the N-word, everything breaks loose. It's awful, which it is. But yet there are many, many blacks in the black community, younger people, I think I've heard more than others, that also use the black word, even talking to each other. But yet nothing's made of that. Is it starting to become a double standard where it's okay for their own community to be using that, but not the other community?
Margaret, thanks for bringing that up. Nolan, what do you think of that?
This is a very, very common debate that comes up, and I really think it's an issue of false equivalency. I think back when I was a kid that, you know, it's all right for me to pick on my little sister, but anybody else does, that's not okay. And the difference between a black person using the N-word and white people using the N-word is that fundamentally white people can't understand what it is to be dehumanized, to be degraded, to have their life chances, to have their life opportunities limited as a result of systemic racism. And to have this term out there as one component of that, in particular to dehumanize people, white people simply can never understand what that is. There's no equivalent terminology for white people, period. And so in many respects, what's happening is you're having white students playing with a terminology whose true meaning, and by true meaning I mean if you actually have to feel and experience its impact, they're never going to understand. And then from an historical perspective, marginalized groups have consistently taken the terms that have been meant to dehumanize them and try to co-opt them and turn them around so that it takes a little bit of the sting out of it. A classic example in the LGBTQ community is the term queer and how it's been flipped on its head. But in many respects, it's up to those communities themselves to be able to navigate that, to negotiate that, because they're the ones who actually understand what it is to be degraded in that way via those terminologies. It's no part, really the only reservation that I have about black youth using the term is that socially it becomes licensed for white people to use it. And so that's why I would hope that they wouldn't do it. But I have. But if they're trying to use it as a way of taking the sting out of the term, it's a completely different issue altogether.
Nolan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It's a good conversation.
That's Nolan Cabrera. He's an assistant professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona, talking about the recent scandal over racist chants at a now-banned fraternity in Oklahoma.